September 1957. That's a spare copy I have.
All our yesteryears, is it?
No. Well, here's the thing, you know. Oh,
combined operation.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then here was the...
It wasn't comic at the time.
Yeah.
So I'll see if we're getting on tape. We should be by now.
Back to this poem, which was entitled Ode to the Nabob, and as far as I remember, it was written by one of our Canadian ERAs. The verse I had quoted before was, upon the quarterdeck we heard a mighty rush of feet, fleet air arm ratings one and all, away to join the fleet. The first verse, which sets the scene, and I'll leave this copy with you, was, we sailed away from Scapa Flow on a dismal August day, out to strike a smashing blow at Von Tirpitz lurking in the bay.
Yeah.
And the last verse, which I think is appropriate, and it was written after we had returned, been towed from Scapa to Rosyth. We laughed and hitched our pants up and pulled away again to Rosyth, port of Scotland, to strip her and remain. So here we lie in languished ease and comfort and in style, with nothing on our minds but time and thoughts of home's last mile. And oft as we lay dreaming of loved ones, food and drink, a thought keeps coming to the fore, we'd best have let old Nabob sink. The following day, after Kempthorne had taken these people off, Algonquin came alongside, and she removed another 204 people.
That was Debbie Pears.
That was Debbie Pears. And I remember this particularly well on a couple of counts. I was up on the bridge at the time, and Debbie called over on his loud hailer, can you let us have some food and some toilet paper? Because he said, I've got practically twice my ship's company, and we're running short. Well, fortunately, we had, I suppose in anticipation of disaster, we had put some food dumps all over the ship, in storerooms or compartments or areas that were not stores for normally for provisions or anything like that.
That was at your behest, I expect. You were pay commander. You were looking ahead.
It was part of our organization to keep the ship going. And, of course, this was patently necessary because the torpedo hit just below the galley, the main galley. It destroyed all the storerooms, refrigerators, etc. And it just took the floor, the deck of the main galley, and blew it up to the deck head above, which was the hangar deck. And as a result, we suffered casualties amongst the cooks. And, of course, the largest number of people who were wiped out were those who were doing the up spirits routine. The rum issue, because the ship had been at action stations and flying stations all day, had been postponed till 5 o'clock in the afternoon when we secured and prepared to oil the destroyers. And the people who were getting the rum out, who were mostly supply rates, a regulating PO, and a witnessing officer who was a chap called Jim Goad, and who had an adventure in his own right, which was written up in McLean's magazine some years later. They were all wiped out, except for Goad, who somehow or other floated up until finally he found a hatch that he could get through. And strangely enough, I met him just as he emerged on the hangar deck. And he was covered with oil, soaking wet. And all I could say was, "Where the hell have you been?" Well, I've digressed. We were able to give Debbie a couple of cases of toilet paper that were in a storeroom that was not flooded, and also quite a bit of food. Because we were then short of our, by some 400 men, plus the casualties, we could afford to let some of our dispersed stocks go over, and these were transferred. We, in order to produce any hot food, we had to use the wardroom galley, which had escaped any damage, and also the captain's pantry, which was on the gallery deck above the hangar, just after the captain's quarters, and that looked after the people on the bridge. But the wardroom galley actually fed the balance of the ship's company, who I suppose at that time were somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 people were left on board, because we had close to 1,000 when we sailed from Scapa. We had bad weather, gale force winds, for the following days, and we were escorted by Algonquin, the remainder of EG-5, and also by the Trumpeter, who was the other escort carrier that had been part of our component of the task force, and she flew AS patrols. And I remember one of our happiest moments was when we sighted a PBY Catalina that was flying out from somewhere or other, the Faroes perhaps, and they kept one on station until we, during daylight, until we got back to Scapa. When we arrived in Scapa, we were anchored. The ship was way down, some 24 feet by the stern. Her bow was just clear of the water. And all sorts of experts came on board, all shaking their heads, because it is notable that Nabob was the first escort carrier that was torpedoed that didn't blow up in her own right. This happened to British ones and also to American ones, like the Liscombe Bay and some that were sunk off in the Leyte Gulf. And it's strange because the torpedo actually hit and exploded on the depth charge magazine, but there was no countermining there. And also the adjacent bomb magazine for the aircraft. We had our problems. Another little item that we had, we'd hidden a 10-gallon keg of rum in the reference book locker, which was adjacent to the officers' cabins, and that came in very handy because we were able to have up spirits. And the captain said that we were that officers were entitled to under the circumstances. So that was a happy little thought. The fleet paymaster who came aboard from Scapa And he said, now, is there anything we can do for you? Well, I said, you can do quite a lot of things. I said, we could, our cooking facilities are very restricted. I said, what about baking us some pies? I hadn't realized at that point that the British idea of a pie is not what we call a pie. Oh, yes, he said, we'll do that. So I said, well, raisin pie or apple pie or something. He looked a little puzzled at the way he went. He said, I'll send my Warren cook on board with it. So, filled with anticipation, the next day, a drifter came alongside, and a bunch of seamen appeared with trays, and it looked like some crumbled cookies with raisins loose in them. And they were carried on board, and I asked one of them, petty officer, I said, what's that? Oh, he said, this is the pie you ordered. So I said, well, thank you very much. And I thought to myself, gosh, they have a great idea what raisin pie looks like. And strangely enough, this difficulty in communication extended itself until I left the ship. We were towed by an ocean-going tug down to Rosyth, and when we'd been to Rosyth before Operation Goodwood to pick up our fancy mines, we had sideswiped the gate vessel on the way out, and we'd wiped off her masts and yards and messed her bridge up a little bit. And this time, as we approached under tow, the ship's company of this tug fell in on the upper deck wearing life jackets. Well, they went alongside, and there was a lot of talk about what was to happen. And the captain, Nelson Lay, insisted that the ship should be dry docked in order to remove the bodies of the dead that were down below. Now, there were 22 to be accounted for, and the local admiral wasn't too keen about this, but Lay was very insistent, as he always was, and got his way, as usual. So we had to strip the ship of as much weight as possible. And the admiral superintendent, whose name I have long forgotten, came aboard one morning, backed up by members of his staff, to discuss the paying off of the ship procedures. And he looked at me and he said, hey, I suppose you've lost all your stores accounts. I looked at Lay. They were all intact because they were in an office that was clear of any damage. And Lay looked at me and I said, yes, sir, I'm afraid they're all destroyed. So the admiral said, good, we'll destore the ship in bulk. Well, after that meeting, I went below to my staff and told my chief petty officer, Storsman, and the chief victualling Storsman, I said, get hold of all the ledgers, your records, and throw them over the side. He said, we can't do that. We've just been working on bringing them up to date. I said, throw them over the side, which we did.
What a lovely way to end a commission for a paymaster.
So that was a great relief. Well, we eventually, I won't go into all the tedious details, but we took everything off, but here's what I ran into, the language problem. I phoned the naval store officer, Rosyth, and asked him for 5 trucks to move stores. And I said I wanted them at 08:00 the next morning. I got up there at 8 o'clock next morning to look for my trucks, and I didn't see any trucks. There were some funny little, what I would call, hand cars on the railway siding, but I couldn't figure out what they were for. They were only little fellows anyway, the sort of thing we have here in our yards. So I phoned up the naval store officer, and I said, what about my trucks? Well, he said, we put them there last night. I said, I don't see any trucks. He said, oh, you meant lorries.
Of course.
So
yes.
I gulped.
You got your five lorries.
Well, yes, the other things were totally useless. They'd have been robbed blind anywhere that they would have gone. Well, the destarring proceeded, and eventually we were moved into a dry dock, which was a dicey business because they had to flood the ship forward in order to bring up her stern to get her more or less on an even keel, and there was a grave danger that she would capsize. However, they put her in, and they started pumping out. Well, that night, we in the supply department had organized a party, a paying-off party, in a hotel in Dunfermline. And we borrowed the Jeep, and I think about 17 of us rode the Jeep to this hotel, where we had a very hearty evening. There was quite a lot of booze. In due course, we headed back for the ship, all 17 of us, hanging on best we could, singing loudly. And when we arrived on board, we found that the dock had been pumped out, and that the officers were in the process of recovering the bodies, which was a thoroughly unpleasant task. So we all pitched in. A very unpleasant night that proved to be, because in many cases rigorous mortis had taken place, or whatever it does. And in order to get them into coffins, which we'd been supplied on, we had to jump on them to push them in to straighten out legs and arms and things. And our baker, who was a nice chap, I always remember him, he had an excellent bakery, as you'd find an American ship, and he had been in the bakery when the torpedo struck, and the deck came up in a great sheet and pinned him against the bulkhead and cut off his legs just below the knee. And we hauled him up with our mobile crane with a sling around him, with his
stumps,
his bones and flesh hanging out. He'd been there in dry air, because it was not a flooded compartment, for 6 weeks. So he wasn't in the best of shape. Well, then, the following day, there was a funeral in Dunfermline Cemetery. The RN produced a guard, and I think they produced a band, too. And Admiral Nellis had come up from London, and a lot of the other brass and that at CNMO. And the following day, which I believe is the 28th of September, 1944, everybody shoved off, and an RN 2.5 took over temporary command of the ship. And the only Canadians that were left were Alan Collins, Charlie Park, and myself.
Al Collins was with you.
Oh, yes, he was Captain Secretary. He was the fifth one we had, but the most successful, needless to say.
Yeah.
And we were left there. The RN 2.5 wasn't terribly flattered with his appointment in command of this wreck, and he didn't go much for Canadians. But the moment that the gang all left, reverted to RN home rations, and the meals took a nosedive. I remember the first...
Any Canadian crew left?
No, there were no. There was just the three of us.
Oh, yeah.
Well, to finish these adventures, Al and I and Charlie Park, who'd been the cash officer, we hadn't returned our money, to which we had to do. And that's why we say, and there were all the files and everything. And one of the amusing things was that when the captain, H.N. Lay, was getting his gear ready to leave, he was going back to Canada, I saw a great pile of packing cases on the hangar deck. And I went to look at them, and they were all addressed to Captain H.N. Lay in Ottawa. And I thought, boy, it sure pays to pay off a ship in bulk.
Yes.
Well, we didn't have very much to amuse ourselves, so we'd go into Edinburgh whenever we could, the three of us. But we had the Jeep, and we'd scoffed off some gasoline from somewhere. I guess it was stuff that was in the ship. It was used for the tractors and the crane and the other gasoline forklift trucks. We made sure that it was there for our use. And there was an officer's club, a rather gloomy one, in Rosyth. But one night, we weren't due to leave for a few days. One evening, just after a very unprepossessing dinner in the wardroom, the three of us were gathered in the ship's office, which was in the gallery deck underneath the flight deck. And somebody sniffed and said, "I smell smoke." So we got out into the alleyway, and there was a great long ladder that went down into the hangar deck. We opened the screen door, and we were met with blinding smoke. The whole hangar was full of smoke. Nobody seemed to have paid very much attention to it. So we quickly went below by another route, and we got outside, and we walked around to look in the hole where the torpedo had made, and it was filled with fire. Flames were leaping everywhere, and you could see the outlines of the bombs and the depth charges and everything else. In the meantime, the RN quartermaster had come to life, and he phoned to the Dunfermline Fire Department. And they arrived on the scene, had one look, said, "Not for them." And they departed. Well, at this point, Collins and Park and I decided there was nothing we could do. There was no water in the ship because there was no power. And we figured the thing would blow up any moment. So we got in our Jeep and we drove to the officers' club, where we couldn't quite see the dockyard, but if the thing blew, we'd be aware. We thought that was a sensible thing to do. Well, as the Dunfermline Fire Department wouldn't take part in this thing, the firefighting school in the dockyard was ordered to come do their thing. And happily, they put the fire out. So the ship did not blow up. But anyway...
What caused the fire?
Oh, some dummy, an electrician, who was one of the very, very few of the crew that were put on board RN ratings, didn't know what was going on, and he made a circuit which ended broken in the damaged portion of the ship. And the sparks ignited the oil that was there. And then the thing started to burn. I brought a couple of things here that might spark some questions on your part. Well, I can show you where we could see the...
You brought another one of your albums.
Oh, yes, I have dozens of them.
Yeah.
B You see, we could stand on the edge of the dock and look in there.
Yes.
And we could see the flames leaping up and the smoke.
The hull goes from below the waterline, of course, very nearly up to the... That's the flight deck? No,
that's the waterline.
Oh, that's the waterline.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah, that's a closer up. And if you look carefully at this, you will see depth charges and bombs. And
yes, I can see the depth charges and the bombs in the album here. And the quarter deck and the picture above is awash in heavy weather, returning to Scapa. And there's a picture, well, that picture is well known.
Yes, it's the old chestnut.
And that's
the main galley.
Your main galley would be hard to work out of there, wouldn't it? And there's, I can see the pennant numbers, that's Algonquin, I guess.
That's Father Algonquin. Algonquin. Well, anyway, eventually...
My memory tells me that we were there with Algonquin. Do you remember Sue?
Yeah. You were in Scapa because I went aboard.
Yes. I saw you on board Sue in Scapa.
That's right.
That's right. But didn't we come back with you, Algonquin and Sue?
I don't think so.
Well, I thought so, but your memory does play a trick.
I don't think so. I think it was just Algonquin.
Oh, well.
Because we had a Zed with us, too. Zambezi or Zambuck or something.
Yes, we were in that flotilla at the time.
Well, I don't think...
All right. Fine.
I don't think we did.
What brought you on board Sue back in Scapa? Our paymaster was Rayburn. I don't know if you knew him.
Yeah. No, I went over just to say, well, yes, and Mark Turco.
Mark Turco.
He's the fellow that introduced me to my wife.
Is he?
Yeah.
I saw him in Montreal a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see his brother, Gilles, quite often.
His brother is retired now?
Yeah.
With what rank did he retire?
3-star general.
What the hell's that?
Lieutenant general.
Lieutenant general? A long way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I eventually took my money and went off in a staff car and had a very nice drive through the Highlands to Greenock. And for some reason or other, I had to turn over my money. And a very pretty Wren officer took it from me. And boy, did she look like a Grand Banks iceberg. But still... I said to her, now look, I'm turning quite a few Canadian dollars over to you that were in the ship safe. I said, I'm going home with my two colleagues, and I said, how about letting me change some pounds into Canadian dollars, and it'll be great for us when we get home. Boy, she gave me a dirty look, and she said, we don't do anything like that. So I said, how about dinner tonight? No! That was the end of that. Well, anyway, we went to Niobe to wait passage, the three of us. And obviously, the bulk of our ship's company, the Canadians, had passed through Niobe... 2 or 3 weeks before that and hadn't left the greatest impression. So we weren't exactly made very welcome. But I've never been in an establishment that was so salty and took itself so seriously as this so-called Canadian base in an old lunatic asylum. It, when we were summoned by the captain, who was Captain Eustace Brock, who told us to behave ourselves, etc. And I happened to be near the front door one day, which they call the gangway, and a young officer came out and says, bring the captain's boat alongside. I thought, gee, this should be interesting because they were up on a hill somewhere. And shortly after, a staff car drove up, and a side party fall in, and a whole gaggle of characters fell in with pipes and things. And out walked Eustace Brock with his silver-headed walking stick, and looking very pusser indeed. And the pipes shrilled and everyone saluted me. I walked out the door. And I thought, you know, there's a war on. This is rather unnecessary. They took themselves very... And the people in the wardroom didn't like us at all. If we happened to know any of the nurses, which some of us did, they were literally growling when we talked to them. I was glad to get out of there. And I took passage in the Queen Mary and came home. And
independently routed?
Yes, took us 7 days from the Clyde to New York. We wandered all over Hell's Half Acre. I remember one morning I saw the Azores on our port beam, which was pretty far south.
Yes.
When we were brought on board, we were sent down below to a cabin that had 20 pipe rail berths. And I found myself allocated to this cabin with an RN Commander E and a colonel in the U.S. Army. And we thought, we were all three stripers, and we thought that this was pretty poor accommodation. So the RN Commander said he knew that the ship's naval commander, they had commanders all over the place. There was one for the Army, one for the Air Force, and one for the U.S. Army. And so he went off to see him, and he must have been very... Well, we all went with him, actually. We protested that we didn't think much of 20 pipe rail berths in the bowels of the ship. And we were allocated to a cabin on the promenade deck, which had three double-deck bunks, like you find in our barracks, or did find in those days. But it was just adjacent to a great long area on the promenade deck, which was accommodating about 1,500 U.S. Army wounded bed patients. And we found that we had fresh water in our bathtub, which was, of course, a great bonanza. We had fresh water running all the time, which normally you didn't, certainly not down in the bowels. So we had rather a good trip. And this colonel was a very interesting chap. He had been an OSS man, and he'd been dropped into Yugoslavia and was working with Mihailovic as opposed to Tito. He took a very dim view of Tito and a very high view of Mihailovic. So he had lots to say, and the RN commander was a very nice chap too. So the three of us were in this six-berth cabin as opposed to three in a 20-berth pipe rail cabin. And on that particular trip, we were served three meals a day because we were going from east to west. And just down the alleyway from where I was, Sir Bruce Fraser and his staff on his way to the Pacific were housed, and Beatrice Lilly was on board. And I remember whistling at her one morning. I didn't know who she was until somebody came and dug me in the ribs and said, "That's Beatrice Lilly." She was a cheery soul. Spent most of her time with the wounded Americans.
Did you meet Sir Bruce?
Must have. I don't recall it as an event of history, but I must have. And he had a whole gaggle of the most beautiful wrens I've ever seen, wren officers, that he was taking out somewhere with him, whether it was the Far East or, yes, it was. Anyway, we got to New York, and everyone was very happy to get home. Collins and Park didn't do quite as well with accommodation, but we got them out of 20 berth pipe rail places. And that wraps up with one other thing I thought of, if I may. When we were working up in Belfast, Ontario was almost complete and preparing to commission. Harold Grant, who was the captain designate, had not joined yet, but Pat Tisdall, who was the executive officer, was in temporary command. And one of the things they had, the ship's company had been gradually joining, but we're all accommodated ashore somewhere. They had a 25-piece band which was allocated to Ontario. And one day Lay said, wouldn't it be nice if we could have Ontario's band for a short time, be good for morale? So he went and he bent or twisted Tisdall's arm, and being senior to Tisdall, he won the day, and the band came to us just for a temporary deployment for a couple of weeks to show them something different than Belfast. So they came on board, and they were really a joy. They played at every occasion. But when the first time we steamed into Scapa Flow, the band fell in on the flight deck, and we came in through the fleet playing Canadian airs, O Canada, Maple Leaf, Alouette, the whole works. You see, this shook up the home fleet no end, because no escort carrier had ever been seen with a band. This was a good band, too, as wartime bands were. Well, in the ship's organization, they were all allocated various duties, and the bandsmen, I think, were stretcher bearers and ammunition passers in the approved manner. And they had a storeroom specially allocated to them where they put all their instruments when they weren't playing. And it happened to be about 5 feet away from where the torpedo hit. And while we returned to Ontario in due course, all 25 members of the band, there wasn't a tutor or a drum in the lot. And they were completely unable to produce any music.
And I think it's probably the last time Pat Tisdall loaned anything.
I never heard any more about that, but I can think of a lot of people who weren't very pleased, because band instruments must have been hard to find during the war. Well, there we are.
That finishes Nabob. Oh, dear. We'll just put it on the tape here, something that you've handed me today. Back a couple of tapes, you talked about the command operations in 1939 in the Ile d'Orléans area. And for the historian, I'm putting on file that it is in the Montreal Gazette of the...
It was reprinted.
It was reprinted in the Montreal Gazette from the RCN Monthly Review in the issue of the 3rd June... No, that's the founding date. The 17th of September. 17th of September, 1955.
But Hal, you remember I showed you that it had been originally reprinted in Crow's Nest.
Yes, I've got that copy here.
I believe it was August 1955. You've got it. You're going to copy it. This is the version that the Gazette printed. And the only changes they made, they changed the naval time designations of 0900 to 0900 hours.
Yes.
Which I presume some brown person must have...
Brown job did, but you want to disclaim that. Yes, I don't
know. Well, I disclaim it.
Yes.
But anyway, and with this was the editorial that came out, and it ended up with something that is true today as it was then.
Read us bits.
We must never be so unready, so alone, and so helpless again. Worth thinking about.
Well, I'm glad that's on record, and I'll put that away, and we'll see where we go from here. Now you have handed me the title of the publication is The Bulletin, put out under the aegis of the Maritime Museum of British Columbia,
Number 25, June 74. You want to comment on it?
Well, the only comment I would make is that I wrote it up for the the Maritime Museum because the ship had commissioned and was manned from the west coast here. Somehow or other, this Tom Lynch, who's an author down in
Maritime,
Nova Scotia, he got hold of a copy of that, and he wrote a thing in a publication called War Monthly, published in England. And when I read, he sent me this War Monthly, and I read it, he cribbed my whole article. Right?
Verbatim?
Verbatim. I think if you look at the last paragraph, which would be where?
In all her appointment of fittings, the Premier. This is about the Premier.
No, that's not it. Here's my version. The Nabob was the first for the RCN. She was followed by Puncher, Warrior, Magnificent, and Bonaventure, all of which added to Canadian naval aviation history. Nabob was not always a happy ship, and she experienced some major traumas in her short career, but all who served in her cannot fail to recall with nostalgia the stirring times in the ship that refused to die.
And that is exactly what I'm reading in the War Monthly of September.
He cribbed my bloody article.
Well, it's called plagiarism, and it's actionable, but he should have at least paraphrased it.
But he didn't.
But he didn't, no.
He put a lot of pictures in.
Yes.
One of which is completely bogus. He said that was Nabob Ships Company. It isn't. It's one of the Prince Ships Company somewhere, because I think I identified. Yeah, there's Robbie on the gangway. Where's the gangway?
Yeah, it can only be Robbie.
Yeah.
So tall.
Yeah. Well, now, do we finish the life history of C.J. Dillon, or do we press on to something else?
So you finish the war now, and then perhaps we'll go on to Korea.
Well, I went back to Ottawa, where my wife had met me. She'd been on the West Coast while all this was going on. And I had 35 days leave somehow or other. I'm not sure how, but that's what I was told. Because we'd all been promised survivor's leave. I don't know. It should then have been more than 35 days. And during that time, I sat for my interview board to transfer to the RCN. The chairman was Captain H.T.W. Grant, and I'm not sure what his appointment was at the time. And there were various people on it, including Paul Cross, who was a captain RCNBR, who was the director of rehabilitation or something like that. And when I went in and sat down, with some trepidation, I must confess, the chairman, Captain Grant, said, "Well, we all know Charles, but we better ask him a few questions." So, Paul Cross said, "Well, now tell me what you thought of our program for demobilizing and rehabilitating the people who had served in the Navy." Well, I said, "I've never heard of it." I said, "Don't forget, I just spent the past year in an RN ship," but I said, "Nobody'd said anything about rehabilitation or demobilization." And with that, Grant turned to Cross and said, "I told you your program was no bloody good and nobody ever heard of it." And they proceeded to argue for 10 minutes, and I was sitting silently at the end of the table. nobody asked me another question. So eventually they said, oh yes, well, you better go out, Charles. We'll call you back. So I went out. I could hear them all yelling and laughing inside. Finally, I was readmitted, and they said, all right, you're in. So I said, well, look, I have a favor to ask. I said, in 2.5 months, I will get my VD, my volunteer decoration. And I said, I'd like to get it. It's something to have after your name. And so they started arguing about that. And finally the chairman said, well, we'll look into it. But in the meantime, you're RCN and you're getting on your way. And I'd been told I was going to Newfoundland as the senior supply officer. So, at Buckmaster's Field. So I left and I went to get my stripes straightened. And I found that I had transferred to the RCN as a paymaster, no, a Lieutenant S, as we were in those days, an acting Lieutenant Commander S, and an acting while holding command.